Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today I'm speaking with Franz Nicolay about his new novel, Someone Should Pay for Your Pain. Franz, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So, Franz, you're most well known as a musician, as a keyboard player and other instrumentalist. But you decided to write a novel. This is not your first fiction, but it is your first full length novel. I wonder why you wanted to write a novel and why you wanted to write this novel.
It seemed like the next step. You know, I had been working up to my first book, writing longer and longer pieces for magazines and so on. And then the first book, Humorless Ladies of Border Control, which was a travelogue, came out in 2016 and, you know, didn't set the world on fire, but did well enough to justify writing another one. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was at a time in my life where I had come off the road when my daughter was born, and it didn't seem like maybe I was going to be a musician anymore. So I was trying to figure out what the second half of my professional life was going to be, and seemed like writing and teaching was going to be the way forward. And so I sort of thought that trying, you know, having done a book length nonfiction, book length fiction might be the next thing to try. And if it didn't work, it didn't work, but that at least I ought to try it.
And this book is sort of, not a travelogue. It's fictional, but there's a lot of traveling around the country, touring around the country in this book. So it feels like a natural progression from the previous one.
Yeah. I mean, there's no world in which you're a musician in which, travel isn't a large part of your experience. You know, you have 2 hours maximum on stage a day, and the other 22 are usually spent either sitting in a moving vehicle or driving a moving vehicle.
Yeah, I heard an interview with John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats a while ago, and he kind of pointed out that, like, when you're on tour, you are on the clock 24 hours a day. Like, that is your full-time job. It is not the 2 hours you're on stage. It's everything. You're always there at work.
Well, and it's also the question about, you know, when people are putting bands together or like which musicians have long careers, oftentimes it's not necessarily the people who are the best musicians, but they are the people who it's the most easy and comfortable and fun to hang out with, because you have to fill those other 22 hours and you have to be around people those other 22 hours.
Yeah. This is something the main character in your book really struggles with. It sometimes seems like he prefers traveling around the country alone in his van with the mattress in back than he does being on tour with other musicians or being part of a kind of package bill. And I know you've done both of those things. Do you have a preference between those two approaches to touring?
It just really depends. I mean, I there's almost nothing I like better than driving around by myself. So I understand that point of view very intimately. But there's also nothing like the camaraderie that comes with it, being in a band. There's a safety in numbers and a safety in volume, that, you know, if you're driving around with people that you know and people you're friends with, there's a gang aspect to that where you can, even if the you arrive and the room's not full, at least you've got your friends around you, and you don't have that protective aspect when you're traveling by yourself. You're really on your own if it's a bad night.
Yeah. I knew you first as the keyboard player for the rock band The Hold Steady. And in that band, you're kind of known as being a very ebullient presence on stage. You're playing the keyboards and you're kind of jumping around and dancing around, and you know, you look like you're having a great time. So I was kind of surprised to read in this book the pretty brutal stories of being on tour. You know, of course they're fictional, but the picture of the touring life that you paint in this book is not a sort of like rock star fantasy. It's very boring and sad a lot of the time. Is that an aspect of touring that you are familiar with personally as well?
That's one aspect of it. I mean, it contains multitudes. You get these incredible euphoric moments, and you get the stretches of tremendous boredom, and you get stretches of tremendous exhaustion, where you have to really call on all your resources to get up to speed for the show. You know, it's funny to me, I've done a bunch of interviews around the release of this book, and people, there's a certain kind of reader who has what seems like an obsession with trying to connect the main character to me. And all I can say is, if you've seen me on stage, I don't see how you would think that a glum character like Rudy, connects to, you know, my preferred performance style, which is much more outgoing. But certainly, you know, you write a book of fiction, and you have to write all the characters. And so I certainly, the way Rudy reacts to things is certainly a something that I can call upon readily. Yeah. You know, I have maybe a better attitude than he does. I think it was more like especially when I was traveling around by myself, you would end up on bills with these older songwriters. You know, I was in my early 30s at the time, and, you know, on bills with people in their mid to late 40s doing a similar thing, who had lost that the energy to fight for the show. And so when I was writing Rudy, I was thinking of it as like more of a cautionary tale. Like,
sure,
had I stayed at it for another 15 years, that's the kind of person you don't necessarily want to let yourself turn into.
Yeah. I was one time in a record shop in Port Townsend, Washington, which is like a pretty small, out of the way town. And the guy, I was buying a Townes Van Zandt record, and the guy was like, "Oh man, I almost saw him. He came through here in 1994 and played at a bar down the street, but I had work, so I couldn't go." I just like could not imagine anything sadder than like one of literally the greatest songwriters of all time performing to like 10 people who don't know who he is in a tiny town in Washington. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you get a lot of those kind of scenes in this book.
Yeah. I mean, I think you get a lot of those kinds of scenes in the lives of people like that, you know, solo singer songwriters. It's tricky. Not many of them get to the sort of sustainable high, you know, theater level, that we often associate with thinking about the songwriters that we really respect. There's a lot of those. you end up playing a lot of second and third tier towns for a few dozen people. On the other hand, that's how you can make it work economically. If you're only one person, you don't necessarily need as much, your overhead is not as high. So if you can make a couple hundred bucks on a show, you can make a living that way if you don't ever go home.
Yeah. I'm interested in kind of this question of like being part of like doing your own thing, having your own, you know, touring in a van with yourself and your guitar versus like being a sort of cog in someone else's machine, which is something that Rudy deals with in this book. He has a friend who he kind of helped out early in his career, but then the friend becomes much more famous than Rudy and kind of takes Rudy along on the road as his opening act. And it goes really poorly, to not to spoil anything about the plot. I was wondering if that's kind of a tension that you've thought about. Like, do you feel comfortable, you know, kind of plugging in and being a part of someone else's vision? I mean, you've played on other people's records. You've been a part of the Hold Steady. You've produced other people's records, but you also have your own projects. Do you find one of those things to be much more satisfying than the other, or are they kind of just two different aspects of the life of a working musician?
I like to do a lot of different things. So I think if I was doing only one of any of them, I would be dissatisfied. And, you know, when I made the decision to leave the Hold Steady in 2009, that was a little bit part of it, is that had taken over my entire creative life. And I'm happier when I can have my hand in a bunch of pots. So, I mean, in terms of like my solo act, I have a realistic sense of where I stand in the pecking order of that sort of thing. So I'm perfectly happy to go on, you know, to play shows or to go on the road as a support act for friends of mine who do a similar thing but are much more popular. I think that's just part of the game. And you want to play to bodies. One of the reasons I wanted to spend some time as a solo act was sort of because of that idea of, with a band, you can escape the brunt of the challenge if it's a tough room. And if you're one person, you can't. And just as a performer, I wanted to sort of test myself in that way. Like, can you get up in front of a room full of strangers and convince them that you're worth their attention?
Yeah.
And to do that, though, you do need people in the room.
Yeah, sure.
And so, you know, one aspect of it, and a slightly more gratifying aspect of it occasionally, is doing these opening slots, because then you do have a full room. Usually, if the headliner is a real headliner, they're not there to see you, but they could be convinced. Mm-hmm. And if you win them over, you can sell a lot of merch and make a lot of new fans. You know, I did a month long tour opening for Frank Turner at the sort of height of his rise in the UK 10 years ago. And that was, I mean, that was great for me, because they were sort of primed to be interested in whoever Frank was interested in. They didn't know who I was, but, you know, I had their ear mandated for 45 minutes. So if I couldn't win them over, that was sort of on me.
Yeah, that does strike me as a very different kind of performer challenge than playing with the Hold Steady, who's a band that has, you know, a pretty intense cult following and has been building that following for 20 years. And so pretty much if you play a show with them, I imagine probably most of the audience not only knows their music, but knows every line of every song.
Yeah, but there were a few years where, when we were establishing ourselves, where we would play opening gigs, you know, mm-hmm. we did... two gigs opening for the Get Up Kids right when they broke up. And that was a lot of blank faces, you know. Their fans were confused at best. I'm trying to think of, we were on a bill once at NYU where it was us and then Iron and Wine solo, which are two very different vibes.
Sure.
The biggest crowd that I've ever played for was, we opened for the Rolling Stones at Slane Castle in Dublin. And you know, 60,000 Rolling Stones fans are not that motivated to be interested in an opening act. So the Hold Steady is no stranger to looking out at a couple thousand unresponsive faces. We don't do that much anymore, obviously. But we certainly did it for a long time.
And you got a song lyric out of that Rolling Stones opening.
Yeah. I'm thinking of others now. We did a month with the Counting Crows. Their fans were slightly more reactive. We did a week with the Dave Matthews Band that was just a real slog, you know, because those fans are just, they're out in the tailgate. They're not even in the shed. So you're looking out at, you know, 10,000 empty seats and five scattered Hold Steady fans at, you know, at 6:30 p.m.
Yeah. Man, I don't know what it is with that guy. I feel like his music is pretty good, but his fans seem to be, well, we don't need to get into that. Yeah. I want to talk to you about your title, Someone Should Pay for Your Pain. I think this is a very interesting title, and it's one that the more I think about, the more kind of alternate meanings suggest themselves to me. It's on a billboard in the novel about like a lawyer who, sort of an ambulance chasing lawyer who said personal injury lawyer kind of guy. But obviously that's not an important moment in the novel other than that it provides the title. And it feels like at first it seems like it's about revenge, payback. But then it also strikes me that it's kind of about maybe what we ask of artists or and maybe particularly performing artists, that they kind of, that they perform their pain for us and we pay them for it, you know, literally with money or with our time and attention. What kind of drew you to this title? Was this a title you actually saw on a billboard? And kind of which of these meanings seem most relevant to you in this book?
Yeah, I think all of those are true. And then there's this aspect of Rudy that's self-pitying in a not very flattering way that I think also ties into that. It was a real billboard I saw, and I immediately wrote it down. It wasn't the title I started with. I was thinking of this book as being called The Morris Column for the whole, while I was writing it. And everyone who read drafts of it said that that's a boring title. You should come up with a better title. your last book had such a great title. How come you can't come up with something like The Humorless Ladies of Border Control? Finally, I did. My friend pointed out to me, I now realize correctly, that I had mistaken my central metaphor for a title and that those two were not the same thing.
Talk a little more about that. What do you mean by your central metaphor being the Morris Column?
Oh, the Morris Columns. There's this famous photograph by Brassai of a Morris Column, which is one of those cylindrical things that you see in some streets, particularly European streets, that the posters for the upcoming shows get pasted onto. And I was just thinking about, you know, the faces of the performers on these wheat pasted posters that they're coming through, their faces there, then it starts, you know, the tape starts to come off and the poster starts to fade or get ripped off by the elements or pasted over by a new face coming along. And so this sort of passing of the circularity of the touring musician's life, where you're very transient. You have about 5 years of a peak if you're lucky, and then somebody new comes over and their face gets pasted over yours. And then just this circularity of touring, especially in the United States, that you're just going around and around and around. And I came up with this long list of metaphors around that. I think most of which are in the book, end up in the book, but like the push mowers with the sort of entwined blades, mm-hmm. that you cut your lawn with. That's what the Devil's Tower thing is about, is this sort of hub of these circles around the country, stuff like that. The circularity, the treadmill that you can't get off. I don't know, this thing, this object that's the place where your face gets pasted seemed like, it still seems like a pretty strong metaphor.
Yeah. There's one question I've been trying to figure out how to ask you, but I guess I'll just ask it in the simplest way I can. Rudy is kind of an asshole. Like, he's a unpleasant person. He's like rude and pretentious and kind of full of himself and makes a lot of really, really awful decisions that hurt other people. He's not sort of likable in a traditional sense. Is that something that you like as a reader? And is that something that you kind of intentionally wanted to do as a writer, to kind of make your reader spend a lot of time in the head of somebody who is in many ways pretty unpleasant?
I do like that as a reader. It's funny that you ask that. I like Thomas Bernhard. I like Welbeck. I like some of these, a lot of these disagreeable characters, because I, you know, it's in the same way that I think some people get turned on by offensive punk bands or you know, boundary pushing comedians, because you get this vicarious thrill out of someone being an asshole in a sort of put on theatrical way, in the way that you don't get to be in your regular life. But also, I think that it's required for the story. You know, plenty of ink has been spilled on this topic of whether or not a protagonist has to be likable. And I think, you know, most sophisticated readers, if I may be so bold, agree that they don't. There's an ego aspect for an author, I think, because of the inevitability of being identified with your protagonist that wants, I think, forces some authors to try to justify them or redeem them or make them more likable. And I don't have that kind of insecurity, I guess, if that doesn't sound too egotistical in its own right. I think, you know, people have these uncharitable thoughts and, you know, uncharitable internal monologues, and a lot of people express them in the world. I think that it's not inaccurate to how people are, especially someone like this who has really removed himself from any social responsibilities. It's not like he's spending a lot of time around people.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. He is pretty alone. Like, not only is he lonely, but he's actually like literally alone for a lot of the book.
Yeah. And so he doesn't, that muscle has sort of atrophied in him, I think, in terms of like how to interact with people and how to be polite or diplomatic or any of the things that might get him the things that he actually purports to want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like a lot of people have felt that over the past year and a half. I mean, I certainly have, that like my ability just to like know how to act around other people is not going real strong right now.
Yeah.
One of the unpleasant thought cycles that your protagonist gets caught up in is a lot of like really poisonous resentment towards his friends who are more successful than he is. And it made me think of the Gore Vidal quote where he said, every time one of my friends succeeds, a part of me dies. Mm-hmm. Is that something that, I mean, you know, without getting, I feel like all my questions are veering towards the sort of autobiographical, but maybe a better way to put it why was that something that you wanted to explore in this book?
I mean, it's a very classic showbiz story in some ways. You know, if you subscribe to the theory that there are only so many stories in the world, one of the oldest show business ones is the person who sees a younger person surpass them, right? It's A Star Is Born. It's All About Eve, that Jeff Bridges movie, Crazy Heart. You know, so that in and of itself is not unfamiliar, I don't think, to anyone. Why think about the resentment? I mean, I think one of the things about middle age, one of the projects of middle age, which is one of the topics of the book, is acclimatizing yourself to your own limitations. And the people who are not able to do that are the ones who get consumed by these kinds of feelings, I think. You know, the publishers listed it as a coming of age book, which I don't disagree with exactly, but I think that we often think of coming of age as something that happens once, somewhere between puberty and, you know, early adulthood. And I actually think it happens, you come of age each time you reach a new age plateau. You have to come of age all over again. And that is something that has to happen to Rudy. And part of that is dealing with this resentment, which I'm not sure I would say he does really.
Yeah, that's, I mean, without spoiling too much of the ending of this, do you feel like that's something that he's closer to at the end of the book than he is at the beginning of the book?
Maybe like a baby step, but not in a way that really solves any of the problems with Ryan, the once upon a time protege. I didn't want to give him, I felt like it would be cheap to give him a real redemptive arc, because he hasn't done that much to earn it. But you do have to see him like nudged slightly closer to the light.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he sidesteps one responsibility by taking on another one, which is morally complicated, right? Because he takes on a responsibility that he will be praised for while evading a responsibility that almost no one will know that he's evaded.
I sort of thought that the sort of Hollywood version of this book maybe starts somewhere around 30 pages from the end, where he makes that second decision, which I feel like it's not spoiling too much because this is on the back of the book. He kind of takes up the task of bringing his niece?
Niece, yeah.
Yeah, his niece, who's run away from home, back to her home. And that sort of feels like it's opening a door into his redemption arc, possibly. And yet that's not the focus of the book, really. Was there, did you sort of think about a version of the book where that was most of the story? And if so, why did you decide to tell this much more complicated, kind of multi-part, non-linear saga of this character's life?
I guess because a complicated story is more interesting than a straightforward Hollywood redemption story.
Yeah, sure. I guess that was an easy question.
Easy answer.
Sure, sure.
Also because the first 100 pages or whatever, the first half of the book was the part that I knew that I had sort of in my mind when I started writing it. I wrote the first chapter as a self-contained short story, and then decided that I could expand that and see if I could get a novel out of it. So with that, the first chapter already implies this relationship between Rudy and Ryan. It implies a backstory with the band. And so, and I sort of had a sense of where the Rudy and Ryan story was going to go. And so it was just a matter of writing those pages. And I figured by the time I got to that point, maybe I would have an idea of what the back half would be. And in the meantime, I wrote this piece for Slate about musicians who tour with their children. And that was really interesting talking to people, not so much the ones who bring their kids on the tour bus and they have a nanny to watch them and so on, but the ones who are actually driving around in a little car with their children and have to, you know, find venues that will let the kids come in and, you know, in some cases the kids would sit on stage during the show, you know, all this stuff. It was so interesting. And I already knew like the Lily character is implied in the first half. And I thought that this would be a really useful device for getting Rudy to get a third party opinion on himself, you know, mm-hmm. because he's been in his bubble for so many years at that point. And if you're in the live music business, I think I say this in the book, you can get away with feeling like you're basically 27 for a very long time, because that's sort of the median age of the, you know, somewhere between late teenagers and by the time people tap out in their early 30s. And he's much older than that, but he hasn't been in a position where he's had to rethink the ideals by which he has, which have shaped his life up until that point. And so to be confronted with someone who really, you know, possibly the only person at this point who really, who looks up to him and thinks he's actually made right decisions, forces him to confront whether he actually wants to defend that point of view.
Do you think that, like, being a touring musician is almost inherently really dangerous, and it's just inherently really easy to make a series of questionable decisions when you're living that life? Or do you feel like this is more of it's the other side thing, that, you know, people who are drawn to being kind of intransient and having these short-term relationships or friendships or whatever are drawn to being touring musicians?
I mean, both, I guess, is the answer.
Great, I've hit it out of the park today.
Well, no, I mean, I think the kind of person who is drawn to this sort of lifestyle where you're inherently always pulling yourself away from long-term connections are the kind of, you know, you're trying to keep one step ahead of your own brain, right? Mm-hmm. And musicians, I tend to think that the people who are drawn to this kind of lifestyle are going to have messy lives regardless. But it's certainly exacerbated by the day-to-day details of that sort of thing. You know, I remember from the early years of touring with punk bands where everybody was broke. You would roll into a place in mid-afternoon and you're not playing till 11. You have to pay for food, but the beer is free and you don't know anything about the town you are. And that's just sort of a recipe for alcoholism, just for example. You know, anybody in that town who wants to get outside of themselves for a night, you're a useful vector for that because you're going to be gone the next day. So you can get ensnared in all kinds of things that people project on you as the visitor who's on the next train out. I mean, it's tricky. It's very tricky. Just on a very basic financial level, you have a hard time justifying yourself because the way the economics of our country is set up, they're set up for people with W-2s and regular incomes. You know, if you want to buy a house, but even, you know, if you want to get a lease in a lot of places, it's tricky if you're getting paid in cash all the time, or you know, in some cases to get a credit card, or all these things that require like a paper trail and a fixed address. Not to mention all the social things about keeping friends and relationships going.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is something that Rudy really grapples with, is this question of like, has he been chasing this dream for longer than it makes sense? But also like, has he been chasing this dream for so long that he's burned any bridge that might take him back to some kind of a normal life?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the people that I know in the business who have had enough success to sort of keep it going past their 20s, but maybe not enough to keep it going into their 50s, that's a very tricky reset to do, right? Because, you know, if you're 35, 36, you haven't had a day job maybe ever, but certainly in some time. Meanwhile, all your friends are well onto their careers and they have a mortgage and they have family and kids and you're starting from scratch. Very tricky to do. And you wouldn't necessarily know it if you're not around. That's another, you know, there's this, Aaron Cometbus is this, you know, well-known writer about punk, and in his most recent book, he uses the metaphor of, you know, you feel like you're running a race with all your closest friends, and you're all sort of, you're having a great time and you're going towards this destination, everyone together. And then one day you look around and you're the only one still running and everyone sort of peeled off along the way and you didn't even notice when it happened. And I feel like that's sort of what happens to Rudy in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a very simple question, but the book contains lyrics of some of Rudy's songs, you know, not full songs, but it, you know, lines here and there. Did you write actual songs for Rudy?
I did. Yeah. I wrote songs for Rudy. I wrote songs for Ryan. And I even wrote a song for Al Pashlow. And that was a real fun writing exercise to sort of, you know, sort of like writing a screenplay. You put yourself in the voice of the character and say, what kind of lyrics would this person write? Same thing with writing the fake Pitchfork review. You know, it's just these like sort of these genre exercises, writing prompts. Mm-hmm. And to sort of differentiate, be able to differentiate a Ryan lyric from a Rudy lyric. Or even to write, you know, Juvenilia.
Right.
Is another, you know, like what would the lyrics of a pretentious 16-year-old sound like?
I gather you have some experience with that life a little bit.
Right? I have some experience with being a pretentious teenager. Absolutely.
Yeah. We don't need to go into that too much, but yes, myself as well. Are those songs are going to come out sometime? Is there a companion novel or album to this novel in the works?
I considered it like a Franz Nicolai Sings Rudy Povert. It's tricky because, like I said, given the extent to which people want to identify you with your protagonist anyway, mm-hmm. It's like how close to the red hot wire do you want to go?
Right.
You know, if you're Philip Roth, you lean into it. Do I have the balls for that? I don't know.
Sure. I have a question about the kind of structure of the book. It's got this very non-linear structure where you're kind of in different times in Rudy's life for a long time, but then those are not presented, you know, sequentially. Were there any novels that were kind of models for that structure while you were writing it?
I actually think it is relatively, I mean, to my mind, it is sort of chronologically simple. It opens in the present day. It flashes back to the earliest point that we see him, and then it carries on chronologically until we catch up with the present day.
I guess it's just like the Odyssey, right? It's the same structure.
It's an opening scene and then a flashback.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me like a pretty straightforward move, like a movie might do that. Mm-hmm. You know?
We've actually already talked about a movie that does that, which is All About Eve. So
yeah.
maybe that was subconsciously in your mind.
And Sunset Boulevard. Right. Also,
yeah.
Speaking of showbiz stories, showbiz parables.
It's interesting hearing you call, you know, you've used the word showbiz a couple times to refer to this book, which I feel like that's a term that a lot of punks would sort of cringe at. You know, I think a lot of punks don't want to think that they're in something called showbiz. And Rudy's definitely not a punk by the end of the novel, but he starts out in a punk band. And I wonder kind of what your relationship to punk is at this point in your life. You had you played on a song on Rock Against Bush, so your punk credentials are you know, very well established. But I feel like punk has a particularly intense antagonistic relationship to any kind of idea of like mainstream success or adjusting yourself to the realities of the world. And it seems like the transition from like being a young musician to being a middle-aged musician might be especially difficult for someone coming out of that scene. So yeah, I mean, what does punk mean to you now, and how has that meaning evolved as you've gotten older?
I think I'm someone who came to it later than people often do because I grew up in the woods, and so there wasn't a punk scene. So it wasn't like these people who grew up in Jersey and were going to see hardcore shows when they were 13. I came to college, and I had a roommate who started taking me to like pop punk and ska shows at the Wetlands when I was 18. And then, so I sort of got involved in that. And then World Inferno, I was 23 when I joined. And that's really, so, you know, in the way that they say about religious converts, the late converts are the most intense, because I didn't have it as a teenage experience that I had to ostentatiously turn away from, if you know what I mean. I love it as an ideal, you know, as a way of being in the world and as a way of being against the world. I think it's a useful stance to be able to access. You know, do I want to be constantly justifying myself to 16-year-old boys on the internet? No, of course not. You know, I'm a 44-year-old man with a car and a mortgage and two kids. But on the other hand, you know, punk's been around for 50 years. So, you know, punk rock is dad rock. and I don't think I'm the first to, I know that I'm not the first to notice that, that the idea of selling out is not the poisonous idea that it was 25 years ago. I would be surprised if anyone who thinks of themselves as punk in these days, I mean, I don't think anyone gives Jeff Rosenstock a hard time for being popular. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They feel like he's maintained what they liked about him and he's just grown his audience. The objections, I think, come when you've really staked a political identity, staked your popularity is tied to your political identity in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, I did this another piece about the etymology of selling out, which I won't get deeply into here. But, you know, it comes from leftist politics. It comes from and race politics of people who are perceived to have betrayed their politics or their racial identity in the quest for success. And so, you know, the last band that I feel like really took the brunt of this accusation was a band like Against Me, because their politics were so tied up in why people were drawn to them in the first place. They were able to move up beyond that. And time has passed, and I can't think of any band that really any act that people seriously have issues with that now. I mean, even people have even come back around on Green Day.
Yeah,
you know, and this is one of the biggest rock, one of the last remaining stadium rock bands that rock produced.
I'm interested as well in the kind of the leftist politics in your book, which kind of intersect with the punk stuff as well. You have one character who is volunteering for Nader in 2000 and then is volunteering for Dean in 2004. So, you know, she's already kind of sliding, you know, maybe slowly and imperceptibly at first, but she's already kind of sliding out of radical politics and into something a little more accommodated to the mainstream.
I don't know. I think people forget that Dean was the radical choice in 2004.
Sure. Yeah. Want to talk more about that?
Well, that was just his positioning against Kerry in the primary. So if you were, you know, the kind of person who would have been a Bernie supporter in the Bernie elections, would have been a Dean supporter in 2004 and would have been a Nader supporter. And like, to me, that's a straight through line, regardless of what the career of Dean went on to do, mm-hmm. that he was the choice for that kind of person, for the like white progressive in Iowa in 2004.
Do you feel like Cass is kind of like the anti-Rudy in a sense, in that like she does sort of seem to find a way to like stay true to what was important to her at a young age, but also to like have a normal life?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why they can't stay together. One of the many reasons.
Yeah. And that's also kind of why she's not the main character, right? Because that's a much less interesting story.
It's a success story.
Yeah.
It's a success story. I mean, to get back to your question about showbiz. I mean, my relationship to showbiz is that I'm someone who's always been fascinated by that professionalized aspect of being a performer and an artist. You know, going back to vaudeville and before. And I think if you're going to be in bands for a living, that's a useful way to think about it. And that aspect of it is what what makes it hard for people coming out of the punk scene to transition to a longer term relationship to it. Because there is this fetish of authenticity and of like, especially emotional authenticity, that if you're going to be playing every night is exhausting to maintain. Mm-hmm. Like you have to professionalize yourself a little bit as a performer and be able to, you know, jump around and do the moves that express exuberance and emotional release without necessarily, you know, diving deep into that pit of catharsis on a nightly basis on command.
And that seems to be something that's like very normal and healthy to me. I mean, I come out of a theater background. So like the idea that you would be on stage pretending to have an emotion that you're not really feeling, or you're, you know, doing the physical motions that get you to that emotional place, even if you're not there originally, feels like, yeah, that's what performing is. But there's a kind of an expectation in at least in kind of certain punk and punk descended musics, that there's something phony about that. I mean, presumably you're not feeling like, you know, jumping around every night, but you go up and do it. Does that ever feel like icky to you? Or does that just feel like, you know, that's showbiz, baby?
Yeah, both. I've gone through phases where it felt intolerable. And I had to pass through those phases because it's a coping mechanism. It's the only way to do it, like you say. And a lot of times, if you act as if, you know, your body and your psyche is very suggestible, sometimes you can get there. And I've come to realize that usually people can't tell the difference. So, to the extent that rock music listeners have hangups about authenticity, which is a real fraught, I think it's a problem with how, especially American music consumers, talk about bands and talk about class and talk about race. I think that makes it hard to talk about. But it's part of being a pro, baby.
I have another very easy question, which is, your book has a lot of fake band names. Was it fun coming up with a bunch of fake band names?
Oh my God, so fun. You know, people do that anyway, right? Like everybody's like, hey, you
I
know,
got a whole list, friends.
You know, it would be a good band name. And so I got to pick some of the best out of that. I thought the plural nouns and various artists.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about the plural nouns in the aughts when the Strokes had their hit, and then you got all these baby Strokes that were all the plural nouns. Mm-hmm. That was a joke I'd had around for a long time. And then various artists, you know, it's like a band calling themselves Free Beer, you know, like if you put that on the chalkboard outside. And then you get to play, once you have the, you have to fill out, I wanted to be very clear to situate Rudy's world as an entirely different ecosystem than our world. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have any reference to any real venue or any real act, because I wanted to make it clear that this is like a parable, that's based on archetypes that we recognize, but that are, you know, very much removed from anyone that a reader might think they recognize. But then you get to play with archetypes. You know, I think everybody knows who's been around this sort of world understands that there's a kind of performer who is like a real name dropper and social climber, and, you know, their record always sounds like who their most famous friend is at the time. Or like with various artists, you know, the band that's like the radical collective, but then they have a freak hit and they find their radical values can expand to accommodate capitalism pretty frictionlessly.
The Chumbawamba saga.
It's the Chumbawamba story, exactly. Yeah.
If listeners don't know anything about the radical history of Chumbawamba, it's a real treat to dive into that Wikipedia hole.
Yeah, I mean, the various artist story is explicitly the Chumbawamba. I find Chumbawamba's story so fascinating. Endlessly fascinating. I pitched a 33 and a third book on Chumbawamba once. It didn't go anywhere, but I've done a lot of thinking about Chumbawamba's career.
I would read that. If you ever get that Chumbawamba book put together, let me know. I'll have you back on the show to talk about it.
Oh man, I would love to.
That leads me to my perhaps last question, which is, do you have another project in the works, or are you kind of like letting yourself take a break after writing your first novel, which congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, I wish I could take a break, but I'm under contract with the University of Texas Press to produce another book of nonfiction, which I'm a couple months past deadline on that one. So I'm a little under the gun. That one is going to be called Band People. And it's a story of, also, you know, the sort of character actors of the popular music industry, the middle class musicians, the working lives, the, you know, how I'm just so fascinated, just sort of from a sociological and economic point of view, about this thing that we call bands, especially the sort of post the wellspring of indie bands and punk bands that came out of the Our Band Could Be Your Life generation of the 80s. Mm-hmm. This combination of quasi-family, small business, creative collaboration, vehicle for all kinds of ideas and politics that in a lot of cases are formed before people are mature enough or forward thinking enough to really think through all of the aspects of creating this kind of family slash small business, and then how they adjust again if they stay in that world, not as a star but as a working musician. And so I talked to about 80-ish people on those topics, and that's the book I'm writing now.
All right. Well, great.
In a way, it's a similar theme, you know, about how do you make a life in this weird ecosystem.
Yeah. And University of Texas Press has one of the best music book series around. So congratulations on getting with them. If I let myself, I would just interview nobody but people who'd written books for them. So
oh, they're killing it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, the flagship is Hanif Abdurraqib's Tribe Called Quest book, which I taught for a couple of years in my writing about music class at Berkeley, and it was always a hit. And there's a lot in there to talk about.
That book's amazing. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Franz, thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts. It was a real pleasure to get to talk to you about your wonderful novel.
Thank you. Always happy to talk. And nice to meet you.